All right, the morning meeting of the Health and Human Service Reform Committee will come to order. We are just short of a quorum at the moment, but we will get there soon, I would suspect. So we will just get into the agenda right away this morning by starting with a presentation from Western America Results First that has to do with the cost-benefit analysis for correction services and for adult mental health. And so when you're ready, Mr. Mayor, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and then walk us through your report.
Chair Schumacher, thank you very much. My name is Weston Merrick, and I am with the Results First Initiative out of Minnesota Management and Budget. Thank you so much for having me here today. By way of background, Results First came out of legislation 2015. The legislature instructed MMB to do benefit cost analyses for corrections and human services programs. This is part of a broader initiative led by the Pew Charitable Trust and the MacArthur Foundation. They're right now operating in 24 states doing this form of analyses. But to be clear, I'm a state employee. I work for MMB. The legislature, when they did this initiative 2 years ago, allocated funding for us to have two full-time staff working on this project. The three questions that we seek to answer, and actually I'll stop there. There's a couple handouts that are available to the audience members. There are two handouts over here for the committee members in your packets. There is a large 8x14 inventory and then a summary document, as well as the full report for adult mental health. So that's available to you all. For some of the research staff, I'll be bringing by the report later as well today. Three questions that we're trying to answer in Results First. Areas that we think that policymakers, both at the state and at the local level, could use additional information. Those questions are, what are we doing? What are the services that we offer in programmatic areas? For adult mental health, what are counties doing? What is the state doing overall? And putting all of those services in one place so that we can access them quickly, understand what the treatment entails, look at the treatment population, and then start asking some questions about effectiveness. The second thing that we wanted to answer is, what does the service cost? And it's no surprise, of course, to this committee that can be a really hard question to answer, particularly on a per-participant basis. There are many funding streams. We have federal sources, we have state sources, we have state grants, we have county levy dollars, we have private insurance. All of these sources coming together to fund our services. So what does it actually cost if we add one person to a service, or two, or five, or 10, or 1,000? And then three, most importantly, and also most acute, what are we actually getting if we deliver those services well? What are the outcomes that we should anticipate? Now, we have a lot of data out there about outputs. We very often know how many people we've served or the total population that we've served. Sometimes we have some information about the percent of folks that have completed treatment, a treatment regimen, or folks that come back and need additional assistance. But very rarely can we say, if we do this service well, here are the outcomes that we should anticipate. Outcomes like declines in hospitalization, declines in healthcare costs, increases in employment, decreases in crime associated with some services that we offer. So those are the pieces of data that we're trying to bring to policymakers in a way that's relevant in the budget-making process. Now, at this point, I want to very clearly add that this is a step forward, but in no ways is this a silver bullet that's going to answer all our questions, and in no ways are we suggesting that we have a monopoly on evidence or that we are the first people to look at evidence. This sort of questions about evidence the legislature is looking at every year, agencies are looking at every day, counties are looking at every day to try and provide services that help their clients. So while this is a step forward, there are some gaps, and I'm going to highlight some of those gaps that we have right now and talk about what this tool is really powerful at doing and what are some questions that we need to pull in additional data and information for. So the implicit goal in here is to produce benefit cost estimates that are understood, trusted, and used by policymakers, both at the legislature, in agencies, in counties, and at the provider level. Supporting that aim, we have an advisory committee that's made up of the three relevant commissioners, NMB, DOC, and DHS. Six legislators, three House, three Senate, three Democrat, three GOP, with the caveat that we just asked Speaker Dowd to replace one Representative Karamack, so we'll be up to six here very soon. Representative from the judicial branch and four county representatives as well. This advisory committee provides us recommendations on directions that we should head, talks about how we can make this information more relevant, and also advises us on other matters that may be important to actually executing our goal. As I mentioned, we were instructed to look at corrections and human services. Last year we did adult mental health and adult criminal justice. This upcoming year we're kicking off with DHS and ADAD division to look at substance use disorder and juvenile justice. In the future, we have the opportunity to look at areas including children's mental health, children's welfare, general preventative services, and there may be some additional opportunities as well to enter other programmatic areas. Just a little bit on process, what we do, the general approach when we start a programmatic area. First, very importantly, is assemble stakeholders. We want to talk to a broad range of folks that are involved in this space. We work with agencies, we work with counties. In this case for mental health, we dove in pretty deep with four counties to see what they're doing to help individuals with mental illness. These counties were Hennepin, Dakota, Olmsted, and Ottertail. We work, of course, with the agencies and across many agencies to look at these services. These, of course, are not just DHS services. There are D services involved here as well. We work with providers and associations to gather that broader context that's important and to understand the offerings that we have in mental health. We then inventory. This is the what that I talked about. What are we actually doing? And I'll get into that a little bit more in just a bit.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Representative Baker.
To the testifier, do we have a handout for what you're going through?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
I just want to make sure I can follow along.
This is just in the PowerPoint version, but in just a second, we'll be going through two handouts, and I'll point out exactly.
So we don't have that, what you're talking about now.
Representative Baker.
I don't believe that I made the slides available, but I will afterwards. Appreciate that. Cost, this is how much does it cost. We look at various funding streams and work with our stakeholders to identify costs. Then we run the model, and that is the how well are we doing. I really love talking about the statistical model, and if there are questions about it, then I'd be happy to answer those. But it is 8:30 in the morning, and I don't think most folks want to get into that. So just high-level overview. This model comes out of Washington State Institute of Public Policy. They've been doing this for about 25 years now. Very interesting shop out of Washington State. The legislature funds about 15 to 20 researchers. And the only thing that these researchers do is dive into rigorous academic literature and look at how effective services are if they're delivered well, and then they do benefit cost analyses. Through our partnership with the Pew Charitable Trust, we get access to this model. Then we present our findings, what we're doing now, speaking with committees, speaking with associations, providers, working with agencies to make these services, make these findings relevant and useful. So this is the inventory of services. It is the 8x14 document that you have. And I can step through a little bit about what this is and what we found. For the audience as well, this document is probably best used in color. It's black and white with the document that's available now, but on our website it is available for everybody to look at. It's MND's website, min.gov/MND/results-first. On the far left side, orienting you to the page, we have our services and practices. And in adult mental health, we identified 39 services that we're offering. The middle columns, description and frequency, duration, these talk about the treatment itself. What are we offering? What are we doing? What's the treatment population look like? How intense are these services? The middle column, I think, is the most important, and that's the impact on the outcome. This is where we dive into the rigorous literature, the academic literature, and find out how effective are these services at delivering outcomes. Now, there are a lot of pieces, a lot of types of evidence, a lot of types of rigorous evidence. We require for our analyses a very specific type. It's called experimental design. You can think of it as a medical trial. You have a treatment group, you have a control group. They're alike in every other way, except the treatment gets the service, let's say mobile crisis. The control group doesn't. We want to look at what the difference between those groups are. When we do that, we can then say that mobile crisis, or whatever the service is, causes a better outcome. And so that's what we're looking for. The categories that we came up with rank from the highest, proven effective. This means that we have multiple rigorous experimental design studies that tell us this service is generating outcomes that we want. The next level down is promising. Maybe we have one study. In mental health, often the sample size is a little small. So we could use some more information, but in general, we're finding better outcomes associated with this service. The third category down is theory-based. Theory-based you should view as a neutral designation. This is a type of service where we don't have the necessary experimental design, a medical trial, yet to tell us whether this service is effective or not. Doesn't mean it doesn't work. Doesn't mean there's not evidence that suggests that it is working. It's just we haven't hit our threshold yet on evidentiary standards. Next level down that you don't see here, that we didn't find in mental health, that we found in other programmatic areas, is no effect. We did not find any services where the rigorous evidence tells us that this is not having positive outcomes on participants. I think that's attributed to the legislature, to the counties, and to the agencies that they are using evidence in their decision-making and removing services that are having no effect or negative effects. The final one is more of a grouping. We call this category of services. When we do this analysis, we try and break it into individual treatments that we see. So a category of services is a bunch of treatments put together, some of which may be evidence-based, some of which may be theory-based, that are delivered together in a setting. The easiest one to think about with this is an inpatient treatment setting. An individual client's going to come in and they may need various types of services. They need psychotherapy. They may need medication management. They may need many intensive services. But it's going to differ from client to client. So we view it as more of a category. The other columns that you'll see in the middle are the outcomes that we looked at. Now, these aren't all the outcomes. There are other outcomes that we see that in the academic rigorous literature that may show positive impacts. But four of the most important that we identified that we looked at are hospitalizations, employment, homelessness, and psychiatric symptoms. The dark blue indicates that we're seeing an increase. We're doing better. We're seeing an improvement. The red indicates that we're seeing a condition go away that we don't want it to go. The gray is neutral. That means the rigorous evidence tells us that there is no impact on that specific outcome. And the white with the asterisk means that the academic literature does not speak to it. We don't actually have an answer yet. And I can talk more about those if the committee is interested. Final columns that are important, continuum of care. This is where in the continuum of services that we offer this intervention. This goes along with and is the same continuum that you all heard about in the governor's mental health task force. We follow that same continuum. Far column to the right, we did speak to a lot of practitioners when we did this. And those practitioners had some other evidence that they wanted us to consider. It may not have been the rigorous evidence that we require in terms of experimental design, so we tried to include that evidence as well.
Mr. Merrick?
Yes.
We have a question. Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, just so I understand your matrix of it, you've got impact on outcomes, proven effective. For example, walking through, it's three quarters of the page down, mental health medication management, you've got that proven effective,
yep.
But yet you have white asterisks, and then on the right it says, mm-hmm. outcomes not yet reviewed. So how does that get to be proven effective?
Yeah, absolutely.
Chair,
for the question. So as I mentioned, there are a lot of outcomes of interest that we look at. For the purposes of this, we're running against complexity versus clarity. And so we identified four of the main outcomes. For medication management, there is another outcome that the rigorous evidence has told us that medication management has,
that isn't in one of these four categories. I'm not exactly sure what it is for medication management, but one of the examples that we often see are things like declines in emergency room use. There may be a proven effective impact on emergency room use that isn't one of the four categories that we have here, and so that would be somewhere else, but it is proven effective on generating outcomes that we want to see.
Representative Precia.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And so just so you know, you're not actually comparing them all to the same four outcomes. It could be on something else that just so long as it gets in this category. Is that how I understand it?
Mr. Merrick.
Chair. Yeah, so we are comparing them. We have identified four primary outcomes, but there are additional outcomes that we think are important that we reviewed the literature on. Some of these are in the full report, and some of them I'd be happy to dive in and let you know which outcome was influenced by medication management.
Just to add, Krisha.
I'll be poignantly blunt here, just so I understand. I just want to make sure that you're just not looking for reasons to put them in the proven effective. I just want to make sure we're comparing apples to apples here and not trying to just justify them based on, oh, we'll use this criteria.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Merrick.
Great question. So we don't actually rate them. It's not MMB that's doing the rating. We rely on other rigorous sources, independent sources to the rating. So the three key places that we look at are Washington State Institute of Public Policy, as indicated by the source of evidence, SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration, which is a federal government agency, and also a unit inside of SAMHSA called NREP, the National Registry for Evidence-Based Practices and Programs, I think, are the ones that designate the impact on the outcomes. So it's not MMB saying that this is proven effective. We go to a third party that verifies whether the research studies examined are of a high enough quality and that have demonstrated the necessary components to be considered proven effective or not.
Representative Krisha.
Okay, so I was done, but that opens up another line of questioning. So then, back to this point, so then what you have here is that it has not been reviewed by WSIPP or NREPP.
Yep.
And SAMHSS has just said this is the best practice. So what you're presenting to me here is the way this looks is you're putting your stamp of approval saying this is proven effective, but what you're really telling us is, well, we really haven't verified that. We're letting somebody else verify, but we're coming to committee with this and saying to you this is proven effective.
Mr. Merrick.
Yeah, we are not the verifiers. So we look at one of three places.
Mr. Chair.
SAMHSA, NREP,
So my question is this. You're presenting this to us as proven effective when your department really hasn't verified that and it's coming from another source that could be suspect.
Mr. Merrick.
Yes,
you shouldn't have said the word we don't verify. So we look at an outside entity to tell us whether this is proven effective or not. We then also review the literature ourselves.
Okay, but I'll go back to this one. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Is this a best practice saying this is a great idea, because that's what best practices are, or is this one actually proven to be effective?
Mr. Merrick.
This is proven to be effective.
Based on what?
Representative Krisha.
SAMHSA.
Mr. Merrick.
But
Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. I know I need to go through the chair. But SAMHSA has said it's just a best practice.
SAMHSA has indicated that in... I guess my question would be, what is the difference? What do you see the difference as between proven effective and best practice?
Representative Krisha.
So if I tell my child, if you take this bike route to school, it's the safest, that's the best practice. If they actually do it and prove they come back alive, then it's verified. Mm-hmm. My question to you is this telling them what the best route is the best practice, or have you actually verified it?
Mr. Merrick,
has MNB verified it?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair. SAMHSA, you're saying SAMHSA has said this is the best practice, therefore it is proven effective. I'm asking you, how do we know that?
We know this through rigorous evidence. Experimental design studies tell us that this has a causal impact on outcomes.
Mr. Chair,
I appreciate it.
And I'm sorry, but that's not what you're telling me. What you're telling me is it has not been reviewed by the other two groups, WSIPP or NREPP, so we don't have any quantitative data. And what you're telling me is that it's moved into proven effective because SAMHSA has not done a study, but they said it's a best practice. That's what I'm hearing. That's what
SAMHSA has. There are studies that have indicated that SAMHSA has reviewed that this is a proven effective practice.
Representative Frisia.
Okay. So then, I mean, when I hear best practice, what that just means is based on what? Are they just saying it's a great idea? We've talked to people that think it's... I'm looking for... This one just concerns me because I don't see the lineage to point to this as being actually quantitatively supported, to be in that category.
It is quantitatively supported.
Okay. And I'll leave it at that, but I see holes in the methodology.
All right, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I know this is kind of a big new idea, and I think it may take more than one hearing. I appreciate that the Chair's having this hearing because I was supportive of this the first time I heard about it. This is a great thing because it gives us some standard to look at the practices that we spend money on. And usually we're just flying in the dark. So I think that, as Mr. Merrick said in the beginning, this is not going to be perfect. But what Representative Krisha, your example, you know, if you say to your child, this is a safe bike route, that's not a best practice. That's just your opinion. And then if your child comes back alive, that's just anecdotal evidence. That's not, so, I mean, I think that, you know, maybe I know you're just pulling an example out of the air, but, you know, I think that we need to try to understand a little bit more, you know, and I think this is great because we all have a ways to go on this. These are really hard. Anytime we look at, you know, social science research or research on these issues, it's very hard to have really good, clear evidence. I mean, there are so many variables. That there are always going to be disagreements. This is never going to be, oh, perfect, it says this, we all agree, accept it. We may, in certain instances, actually have to dig into the evidence. But I just think that we should, like, give this model a little bit of an opportunity because it really is a new idea. And, you know, I represent Krisha. I don't know what your background is, if you're from science or from business or anything like that, but... You know, most of us don't come here as experts on this, and I think that what we have here is just a really good tool to start to get us to be able to spend our money more wisely in a lot of these areas where things are really fuzzy. But I think we just need to, I'd really like to let Mr. Merrick get through his presentation and kind of, I don't know what else is here, but I'm really interested in this because I just think it's a new way of thinking about things. And I don't think his point is to tell us we must do X project or that this thing is better than this thing. It's really, we're still the decision makers. I think what he's doing here is just offering us a tool. But your example, your analogy, I think was maybe not one that's very helpful, and maybe, I don't know, maybe Mr. Merrick has a better analogy that would help us understand more, you know, because I do think there's a confusion between best practice and evidence, you know, what does it mean to have something be evidence-based, and, you know, so maybe that's just a clue for you today or for a future presentation to be more clear with us about what that means. Thank you.
Representative Krisha.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the comments that were raised, I'll run my analogies to the committee from now on. I apologize if they don't meet the criteria. However, I believe what you've done here is good work, and I want to make sure that the data you put in front of us is something we can support. Mm-hmm. You're a bright enough individual that I think that you can handle a line of questioning to make sure that what you put in front of us can be tested and proven true. Furthermore, I believe the truth can stand a little bit of beating up. And if this is as good of a tool as we think it is, let's poke holes in it. Let's find out what we can get behind and make sure it works. But with all due respect, Mr. Chair, I guess I'll write my analogies up a little bit better before we come to committee.
Representative Krisha, if I may, sure. I completely agree with you. This methodology, as you ask questions like this, we get to understand a little bit better what the evidence means because it is very complex. There's a lot of complexity in here in determining the varying levels and what is evidence-based versus best practices. So I thought it was an excellent question and a very warranted question. And to Representative Newbern's point, I agree. I think that this stuff is nuanced, and it's going to take a long time for us to get through. and that we should subject to a very high standard because we are bringing forth considerations for the committee that we'd like the committee to use going forward. So thank you.
All right, back to your presentation, Mr. Merrick.
Appreciate it. So that is our inventory. We can set that aside for now and actually go into, well, headline findings of the inventory. Of the 39 services that we saw here in Minnesota, 23 of those services are proven effective and promising. I know I mentioned that we have a network of states that we're looking at. Relative to that network of states, this is a pretty high percentage. We're doing well in a lot of places using proven effective and promising services, and that's a very good thing. So pointing you to the two-pager that you have, that is the adult mental health services summary, on the front of the page, on page one, you'll see a data visualization that is very similar to this up here on the screen. I want to talk a little bit about what benefit cost analyses means. And if the header on it is results first, and it says benefit cost analysis report, adult mental health, January 2017. So on that first page, we talk about what benefit cost analysis is. What you'll see on the next page are some figures. A dollar into a service is going to lead to, in this example here, $2 back. So what does that mean? That means that we see two categories of benefits. There are taxpayer benefits, and there are other societal benefits. Taxpayer benefits are things like avoided hospitalizations, the avoided use of the emergency room, if we have increased tax income relative to increases in employment, we have declines in the use of the criminal justice system, we have savings in arrests, prison, jails, supervision, courts. And on the other side, we have societal benefits. These are going to be both related to declines in victimization, related to declines in criminal justice system interactions, and then also, most importantly for adult mental health, a lot of this is going to be labor income. So if we see increases in employment, that are caused by these services will have increases in societal benefits. From that inventory of 39 services, we're able to do the full benefit cost analyses on 7 services. The reason for that is it has to be in our statistical model. We need a lot of data available to us, this Washington State Institute of Public Policy statistical model. In future years, we're going to be able to add additional services as Washington State adds more services to the statistical model. For example, first episode psychosis got released in that model about a week before we released our report. That is something that the legislature funded in 2015. And in future years of analysis, we'll look at first episode psychosis. Of the 7 services that we examined, all had positive benefits, so benefits that are greater than 0. Positive benefit means we see some outcomes that we like. A negative benefit, a benefit that's less than 0, would mean that we're getting harmful outcomes, that a dollar in, we're getting worse off. We didn't see any of that. All of them are at least generating some positive outcomes. 6 and 7 also have benefits that exceed the cost. A dollar in, you're going to return in taxpayer and societal benefits more than a dollar back. Now, we only looked at 3 types of benefits as well. Healthcare costs, hospitalizations primarily, employment, and crime. There are other benefits that we didn't monetize. Things like psychiatric symptoms, homelessness, global functioning. These are the things we can't put a monetary value on. Now, homelessness, we can put a monetary value on outcomes like the changes in hospitalization or changes in employment. But the physical act of not being able to go to a home, we can't monetize. So we don't do that. The report's going to talk about some of those outcomes in greater depth. It is not included in the benefit cost analyses. I also want to mention that benefit cost analyses focuses on cost effectiveness. It's a very powerful tool for looking at cost effectiveness. But there are other values that we have. There are other reasons that we do services. We do things for innovation purposes. We do them for equity. We do them for fairness. We do them for justice. This report doesn't speak to those aims. We're focusing narrowly on cost effectiveness. We'd like to speak to those, as I'm sure when policymakers consider legislation they do. There are other sources that you should pull in, because this is just going to look at cost effectiveness. So the findings in general, we have on the back side of that two-pager, you'll find the 7 benefit cost analyses available. They're in 2 major groupings. There's 6 of them together, and there's 1 by itself, and I'll talk about why one of them is a little bit different. In general, of those first 6, we see a benefit cost range of $3.90 to 80 cents. Looking at an example, mobile crisis at the top. For those of you that aren't familiar, mobile crisis is a service that if an individual is going through a crisis episode, they can call a county call center. That call center will then send trained professionals to assist that individual. Maybe they do stabilization or other things, connect them to services if necessary. That's opposed to a police response, generally would be the alternative, or a going to an emergency room. So we looked at the costs in terms of a typical Medicaid medical assistance recipient, and we found that looking at mobile crisis, a dollar in is going to lead to $3.90 in benefits. $1.20 of that is going to be taxpayer benefits, so things that governments do, health care, crime-related services. $2.70 of it are other societal benefits. These, in this case, it's resulting in a decline in crime. Altogether, we see over the course of 1 year, if we offer this service, we see $1,280 benefits, dollars in benefits minus the cost, the net. The one service that's a little different is cognitive behavioral therapy. Everything else we looked at 1 year, because essentially, for most of these services, we get the benefit as an individual is going through the treatment. For cognitive behavioral therapy, it's a little bit different. Instead, the research tells us that there's prevalence and persistence. So a dollar in, we're going to see benefits over the lifetime of an individual through declines in the underlying diagnoses, the symptoms of the underlying diagnoses. 3 diagnoses, adult anxiety, PTSD, adult depression. We see a range of benefits over the lifetime of the participant of between $30 and $66. So the report also talks about some key considerations, and I realize that I'm very close to my time, so I'll go through this pretty quickly, go into more depth in the full report. But as this committee has heard before, there are gaps in service availability. We found through our analyses, and also DHS just released a adult mental health grants report that indicates that there are areas in the state where we need additional services. The services tend to vary from county to county as well. If the services are not implemented with fidelity, if we don't deliver the services as we should according to the research model, we won't see the benefit-cost ratios here. In the report, we indicated some places where we did not, we found that the model was not being followed, and because of that, we may not get the anticipated outcome. And finally, much of our present system, the spending occurs towards the end of the continuum. This analysis looked at the middle of the continuum mostly. We think that we can get better outcomes and more cost-efficient outcomes if we're able to push up early into the continuum, into things like prevention. And I'll go ahead and end there.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Merrick, for your presentation. We did save a little bit of time this morning for questions from members. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Merrick, when you're doing your cost-benefit analysis and you're projecting what a program will gain, do you look at scalability in that if it's aimed at a very, a group that is most highly affected by a program, and then as you scale it up, the effectiveness is decreased? Do you ever look at that scalability, and that way it's good for us to know, This is great if we target it, but if we triple the money going in, you're going to decrease to where it doesn't really show that last third?
Mr. Murr.
Thank you, Chair. Great question. So I think what we're getting at is like the idea of diminishing returns to scale, right? That if we are almost near, if we're picking up folks that have lesser and lesser conditions. So no, we don't. We look at the outcomes based on the evidence, and that evidence is based on the population that was treated. In general, those are populations that need the service. And so this is the outcome for that we see in that rigorous research. We don't really have any way to look at diminishing returns to scale.
All right, Chair Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate MMB starting to take a look at some of this stuff. You know, typically we measure how we're doing by how many people did we serve last year, how many people did we serve this year, how much money did we spend last year, how much money are we spending this year, and we measure how we're doing by metrics of dollars spent and people served, and that's a really bad way to measure how we're doing. The metrics that you're kind of getting around, I really appreciate, and I also appreciate Representative Kreisha's questions and kind of how you measure stuff and who measures it. So if the Progressive Policy Institute measures something and Heritage measures something, they're going to come to different conclusions about whether or not it's effective or how effective it is. Mm-hmm. And I understand that, and you kind of have to start from someplace if we're trying to get better value. But one of the things that I was thinking about after I first saw this study was some of us were just down at the Mayo Clinic, and we looked at their surgical department. And, you know, it's blocks and blocks long. And they have established procedures and practices around stuff they want to have happen and stuff that can never happen. So stuff that can never happen is you do stuff to the wrong person, wrong site surgery, you know, you operate on the right leg instead of the left leg, or you leave stuff in people. And they have, through doing the same thing over and over and over and over and over, basically gotten rid of those things that can never happen. And it seems to me that in things like child protection, we have lots of stuff that can never happen that happens all the time. Did you look at all at things that, you know, number one, should we stop doing this thing, or is this hurting people, and how do we stop that? And do you have, you know, did you think about, or do you mm-hmm. envision can't happen stuff that we could measure how we're spending money and if we're hurting people?
Mr. Merrick.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Dean, excellent question. We looked at, in this analysis, the services that we saw. So every service that we found in adult mental health, we included in the inventory. Now, in mental health, we didn't identify that are having any services that are having harmful effects. We anticipate that in future areas, programmatic areas, we will find those services that are not having, or that are having harmful effects, and we will identify them in the inventory. I think also a little bit what you're talking about is prospective analysis. So one of the things that we could do, but have not yet, is actually identify services that we don't have here, that we're not doing yet, and whether those services have helpful effects or things that are harmful that we shouldn't be doing. So that is a potential area that we could do. We just haven't yet.
Chair Dean. Representative Kuhnhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your testimony, Mr. Merrick. My comment is this: I appreciate all this information, but you know, as a layperson, one of the things I look at is recidivism rate. In other words, how many of these people that are in this program actually have to come back and go through it again and again and again? And to me, that's the gold standard in chemical and mental services, is the recidivism rate. I mean, it's easy for people in the public to relate to it. Mm-hmm. And what I find is that the recidivism rate in like AA or Teen Challenge is much lower than in some of these so-called proven effective programs. And, you know, you can take a lot of this information and put it off to the side for me. And not that I don't appreciate what's put here or done here, but the recidivism rate is what I'd really be interested in. Mm-hmm. And then the cost per person, because we know if we keep recycling the same people through the same system over and over again, and then we stamp it as proven effective, mm-hmm. That doesn't mean too much.
Yeah.
One last example. You know, when I was on the school board, I can't help but keep bringing this up.
No, you can't.
The, you know, things just kept coming down to the school just about every year. You know, and teachers, some of the older teachers, they just, you know, put their head down and shake their head. And they'd, you know, it was one experiment after the next, and it was always called best practices 9 times out of 10. And what I found is the best practices usually cost the most and had the worst results over a long period of time. Now, this was confirmed by senior teachers, and also who many times got heavily criticized for not going along with it because they're sick of these experiments flushed down from the U.S. Department of Education, Minnesota Department of Education. But I see similar things here. Sometimes, not that human nature would do this, but there seems to be so-called best practices or proven effective tied to sometimes the amount of money that comes with the program. Not that that would influence anybody, but I'm just saying that's been an observation of mine. And I'll give you one last example from the school board. You know, they came down with the four-period day. Well, we went with the four-period day. Well, it raised our cost, our staff cost, over $100,000 a year in our school district. And it had shown time and again to reduce the effectiveness of teaching math and English to our students because they weren't getting it consistently on a daily basis. I and the superintendent were strongly opposed to it, but the school board voted it anyway. And again, it came down with this best practices stamp on it. Yeah. So, you know, forgive me if I have a certain level of skepticism, but I'd really like to see recidivism rate. Yeah. That's what I'd like to see. And I think the public could relate to that pretty quickly. Thank you.
Mr. Merrick. Thank you, Chair. For our adult criminal justice inventory, when we look at the key metric we look at, the key outcome we look at is recidivism rate. In mental health, the outcomes we're talking about, do we see a statistically significant? We see a significant impact on these outcomes. We are tied to that research, so we have to use the evaluations that are available to us. MMD is not going into the field, setting a treatment and control group, evaluating that treatment and control group for 3 or 5 years. Instead, we're reliant on that rigorous research. And so where that sort of information is available in the rigorous research, we can certainly provide that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kernhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for that response. But in all the material you've given us today, is recidivism rate listed anywhere in it?
And when we say recidivism rate, you mean the rate upon which someone returns to treatment?
To the program or actually is cured and moves on to a better life.
So the researcher talks about successful outcomes. You can think about the flip side of that as an unsuccessful outcome. But no, we do not specify the likelihood an individual will come back to the program.
Mr. Chair, just one more
thing.
You know, and everybody in this room, think about that. Recidivism rate is the gold standard on evaluating the program, yet the materials we have today, we don't have that data in a readily available form. And as lay people, how do we assess anything unless we see that recidivism rate? It's really that simple. I think I'm done talking, Mr.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I didn't raise my hand to respond to Representative Grunhagen, obviously, but you know, I think there's a confusion between recidivism is a term that gets used in criminal justice. When we're talking about people in the mental health area, you know, I think maybe you mean that, you know, continuing to need treatment or something like that. But, you know, sometimes mental health is kind of a chronic, mental illness is kind of a chronic condition. And so, you know, if we had the magic pill and could cure it, I guess we could measure who gets cured. But that's sort of not the way anyone, I don't think, expects. That's not what we expect to see in mental health. So the outcomes that are on the sheet here, the ones that we're able to see, like hospitalizations decreased and homelessness decreased and psychiatric symptoms, I mean, that's kind of what you look at for mental health. But this model, I think, did go out of the criminal justice area where recidivism is a big measure. So we just have to, this isn't about recidivism right here. But anyway, the reason I raised my hand was to ask a couple questions of Mr. Merrick. So I don't think I heard anything about how the state is possibly going to use the tool. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's not your decision to make. I'm sure it's probably a lot of it's our decision to make. But I'm kind of wondering, for example, if there is a new program that someone wants to bring forward, do we submit that? Can we submit it to the Results First program to see if there's data on it? If when we get fiscal notes on programs, are they going to have this data in them? I'm just kind of wondering what the vision is about how this is going to be available to us going forward.
That's an excellent question. Thank you, Chair. That's an excellent question. So we envision a couple of things, and we can also look at some of our partner states to see what they did. That can be informative. Specifically, one thing that MMB will do is we are starting to review the process upon which we embed these sort of pieces of evidence into review of the governor's budget. When policy proposals are brought forward, we're going to figure out a way to start to include this information. In fiscal notes, information like this presently can be included in the qualitative narrative. And as well, to your point, if there are services that you're interested in, we could take a look at the literature and see if there's anything available. At the other point, there are states that have taken this data that have been in this initiative far longer than we have. We just released results in December, that have used it to inform the legislature, inform agencies, inform counties, and helped change practices in contracting, have made available grant dollars on a competitive basis. Then those grant dollars, a percent of them had to go to proven effective or promising practices. There are a lot of mechanisms by which we could increase the use of evidence in policymaking. There are other states that have included in statute what evidence is defined as. The legislature has thought about what they want those levels to be, and so that we all have a consistent definition when we're using them across agencies. So different types of levers. I'd also be happy to identify some others that Q has identified that states are doing from these sort of results.
Thank you.
Representative Grunhagen, a quick follow-up.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and I appreciate the comments that have been made. But I would go back to this. When I look at Teen Challenge and AA, they do use recidivism rate. And these people that are in these programs have mental, emotional, and chemical problems. So it is a valid measurement, not only of the criminal justice system, but also in terms of mental health issues, to see what we're actually accomplishing in terms of methodologies that do produce a higher rate of people going through the program that actually are restored back into society. So I respectfully disagree. Thank you.
Representative Krishaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, Mr. Merrick, just three quick follow-up questions. Do you have further plans for this study? Are you going to update it? Is this a one and done? What are we going to see?
Great question.
Mr. Merrick.
This is ongoing and continuous, and so we'll be moving on to substance use disorder next, Teen Challenge, and Alcoholics Anonymous, as well as 12-Step and many others will be in that analysis. We also plan to, every couple of years, update the findings. So every 2 to 3 years, we'll come back to a programmatic area and talk about the new research we find, the new services that are being offered.
Representative Fisher.
And two more, thank you, Mr. Chair, and two more, and I'll ask them together so you can just answer them both. As you go forward, have you thought of a Venn diagram showing duplication of services? Be nice to see where there's overlap. And to that same point, in those duplications, if the law of diminishing returns applies. So I've seen some programs where maybe we get two or three services overlapping and the returns actually diminish. So those would be my follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Merrick.
I think those are great considerations, and we'll think about those in future studies. Duplication of services is certainly an area that we've heard feedback on that I think may be useful.
Any other questions for Mr. Merrick in the presentation this morning? All right. Seeing none, Mr. Merrick, the committee thanks you for your testimony and your time this morning and the presentation that you gave us.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. All right, we do have a quorum now, so I will officially call the meeting to order. And Representative Keel will move the minutes from January 31st. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes?
Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the minutes from January 31st, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. The minutes from January 31st are adopted. Next up, folks, we have members. We have an overview of the medical assistance spend down requirements and process. There was a report that came out in February of 2015. We wanted to review that just a little bit. It is a little dated, so we asked for a little update on that, and that's what we will have presently. So, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and begin with your report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Kim Carlin, and I'm a healthcare eligibility policy manager at DHS. I'm here today with my colleague, Meg Hines. In February of 2015, the department issued a legislative report as required by the legislature in the 2014 session. The commissioner was charged with, in consultation with interested stakeholders, to review the medical assistance spend down requirements and processes. I believe you have that report in front of you. We were asked to review the report with you today with a focus on how spend down works in Minnesota. Spend down is a term that we use that refers to the optional medically needy groups for coverage under the medical assistance program. People who have countable income over the income standards for medical assistance may still achieve eligibility if they have incurred medical expenses in an amount that's been deducted from their income, brings their countable income down to those to the spend-down standard. Page 7 of the report outlines the eligibility groups for people with MA income standard. So you'll see the different eligibility groups, parents and relative caregivers, pregnant women, et cetera, people who are age 65 or older, who are blind or who have a disability. So the second column tells you the MA income standards, and then what the spend down standard is for people who have income over those limits. As mentioned, the report is out of date, so the actual dollar figures have gone up since the report was issued. The spend down standard for people age 65 or older who are blind or who have a disability was increased by the legislature effective July 1st, 2016 and went up from 75% to 80%. So MA pays for covered services starting with the first dollar of bills incurred over the spend down amount. For example, if a person whose basis of eligibility is disability, they are subject to 100% income standard. If their income is over 100%, then they have to spend down to 80%. That means that we deduct their incurred medical expenses from their income, and if that income, if that calculation results in income at or below 80% of the federal poverty guidelines, then they are eligible, and medical assistance will start paying with $101. Say they're $100 over the income standard, then medical assistance starts paying bills at $101 that's incurred. So once a person is found to be eligible under the spend down standard, providers submit their claims to DHS for services that are provided, and they receive a remittance advice showing the amount that DHS will pay and the amount that the enrollee is responsible to pay. Providers then bill the enrollee for that amount that's coming to them. Non-payment of spend-down amount does not impact a person's eligibility. However, providers may refuse to provide further services to an enrollee if their standard policy is to stop providing services to people, to patients who have unpaid debt. Most often, the spend-down is applied to claims as they are received. This is referred to as potluck processing, and this is discussed on page 11 of the report. In this scenario, enrollees pay their provider once they receive the bill. So as bills come into DHS, the spend down amount is applied. Again, in an example where somebody has a $100 spend down, the first $100 submitted is rejected, and then starting with $101, the bill is started to be paid. And so then the providers receive their remittance advice and bill the enrollee. There are a couple other options also used. One, the client option spend down, or the designated provider option. These options are discussed on page 8 of the report. The client option spend down is used in that option. Enrollees pay their spend down directly to the state. Not a lot of people use this option. It's primarily helpful to people who always have bills to meet their spend down. They know that they're going to meet their spend down every month, and so they pay that amount sometimes to the state. The designated provider option is one for certain enrollees where they can know that they will always meet their spend down with bills incurred by a specific provider. And so they designate that provider to have the spend down applied to, and then they're always billed that same amount by that same provider. That's a really quick run-through of how spend down works. And so we'd be happy to take your questions. I think we can go from there.
All right. Questions? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking on page 9, and I just see that the number of MA enrollees with the spend down have gone down over the past several years. Do you have an explanation for that?
Ms. Carlin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, the numbers in the report show the age blind disabled category and the parents and children. For the parents and children, I assume that's going down because the income standards have gone up for that group. For people age 65 and over, blind or disabled, I don't have an explanation. I think our MAEPD program is growing and more people with disabilities are working. It may be that people are moving into that program as an alternative. In the MAEPD program, people are paying a premium rather than a spend down. So oftentimes, but not always, that premium amount may be lower than their a spend down.
Representative Peterson, okay. Any other questions for the testifiers? All right, seeing none. Ms. Carlin, Ms. Helm, thank you for your time this morning and for the testimony that you were able to give us on that. Members, that gives us a little background to the next bill we have up this morning. House File 225, Representative Zerwas. As he's making his way down, I will move that House File 225 be referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. And Representative Zerwas, it looks like you have an amendment for...
There's an A1, Mr. Chair.
All right, I will move the A1 amendment. Representative Zerwas, to your amendment.
If you look at the A1 amendment, it's changing on line, page 1, line 9. It's inserting or more after 2, so it's 2 or more.
Okay, any questions about the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Zerwas, the bill is in the form that you wish. To your bill.
Mr. Chair, members, House File 225 is the MA spend down bill. This bill or various versions of this bill have been around for quite a while now. 2 years ago, in the last budget year, we were able to make progress on increasing from 75% to 80% the MA spend down amount, allowing people to keep 5% of their own additional of their own money in their pocket. And so we're trying to continue to move the needle that stands be a fairly expensive piece of legislation when we look at bringing the spend down limit all the way up to 100% and increasing the asset limit amount, which we were not able to do 2 years ago. And so the goal of House Bill 2025 is to change MA policy so that people with disabilities and seniors can keep more of their own income in their pocket. The bill increases the MA spend down limit up to 100% of the federal poverty guideline and increases that asset limit to $10,000 for an individual. Medical assistance for people with disabilities and people over 65 is different for low income and those covered by the MA expansion. For people with disabilities, they must be certified by the Social Security Administration or the state. It must be at risk of institutional care. And this is the only pathway for people to get on a disability waiver. And that comes with its own set of qualifying standards. Currently, if you earn $1 over the federal poverty guideline from your Social Security disability, and right now 100% of FPG is $990 a month. And so if your Social Security disability comes in at $992 or $991, that spend down to 80% automatically kicks in, and every month you have to spend down to $792 a month. And then, and only then, can you start trying to pay for the things you need to live. Your rent, your electricity, your food, maybe some more medications. And so it's really a heartbreaking public policy that we have that targets our disabled community in a way that it doesn't target anybody else. What ends up happening is you have people at the end of the month that oftentimes are trying to choose between heat, food, and if things really go well and everything lines up, they might, just might, have a few dollars to be able to go to a movie at the end of the month. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about the spend down. Last year, 2 years ago, in Chair Dean's budget, we increased the spend down amount from 75% to 80%. For every 5% increase in that spend, in that threshold, it equates to about $50 in the pocket that someone gets to keep of their own money. And so we made progress, but there's a lot of work left to do. Jeff Nashmeyer is here to answer some questions, Mr. Chair. Otherwise, I know that we have a few testifiers. In the interest of time, I think we should go to testimony.
All right. Welcome to the committee, to the testifiers. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Preston, and I live in Hopkins. I wish I could look you all in the eyes and tell you my story, but because of my brain injury, that's impossible. I sustained a traumatic brain injury in 2005 when I was T-boned by a drunk driver. Memory problems from my brain injury make it hard for me to concentrate and do simple things like pay bills and interpret mail. I'm grateful for the help I get from the medical assistance waiver program. My independent living skills worker helps me stay organized. Helps me stay organized and independent in my own apartment, which is something I never thought I would be able to do again. Okay, I receive about $1,000 a month from Social Security Disability Insurance, which I paid into working two jobs before my accident. I'm expected to pay almost $300 of my medical bills each month before MA starts paying. This is known as my spend down. After paying my rent and spend down, I have about $70 left to pay all my other bills. It feels like I'm being penalized for working hard my whole life and paying into Social Security. To make ends meet, I rely on food shelves, which have mostly unhealthy food choices. It makes no sense, and I'm expected to live below the poverty level to get the help I need to stay independent. Please support House File 225 to change the medical assistance policy so I can keep more of my Social Security income so that I can pay my bills and stay independent. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Ms. Preston, for your testimony. Are there any questions for Ms. Preston this morning? All right. Thank you for your testimony.
Sit next to you.
Come on over.
Behave. Chairman, committee, my name is Rick Seiler. I live in downtown St. Paul. I do have a brain injury, and I do keep losing track of what I'm saying. But I am a former elected official, so I'll try to get it to you the way you like to hear. I received a traumatic brain injury. I was rescuing a girl in a car accident. I was coming onto the freeway, and I was just coming from the hospital. And I pulled over to the right because I see her flipping. She did like a little corkscrew. And all I could see was a body flipping around on the inside of the car. So I assumed right away she was in dire need of assistance. I backed up into the on-ramp. I went down. I did a lot to get her out. Got her into my car. Sat down in the driver's seat. As I got out of the car, all I could see was a flash. I was just going to talk to the patrolman. And tell him, I'll just take her to the hospital, you know. All I see was a flash out of the side of my eye. And a car hit me at 70 miles an hour and crushed everything from here on down. They didn't just hit me, he smashed me into my car. So pretty much everything from here on down destroyed. I have very limited ability now. You know, my right leg don't work, my arms are real bad. And I'll do this just a minute. Yeah, the car hit me anyway. I was laying there and the cop helped me out. Paramedics took me to the hospital. I spent 4 months in a coma, an additional 6 months in the hospital. The reason I'm here today is the spend down. Spend down on the poverty level, but spend down, my situation with that spend down, $400 a month. I make $1,034 on Social Security. That means I am, $70 over the poverty level. Therefore, I pay a full $400 a month. Now, I make $1,000 a month. I have to spend $400 a month on medical stuff. And that's before my insurance. There's an additional $160 on my insurance. Okay? And then, you know, you got your, there's some meds that they're not going to cover. You got to have over-the-counter stuff. Okay, my Social Security check is almost gone right there. Now I've tacked on an additional $700-$800 a month for rent. You can't do it. It's totally impossible to do. If I'm going too fast, I'm sorry, all right? And, so I went from rescuing this girl to make me get rescued myself. I worked 25 years as a construction worker. I was in the military for 6 years. and I was a city councilman for four. I have done my bit for King and Country. To see the state is the one that's actually stopping me and all the other disabled people from being able to live on our own. It's very heartbreaking to know that the government that I elected and appreciate, and I'm a totally nonpartisan member here, everybody. So anyway, let's open you guys up for questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Snyder, for your testimony this morning, for your service, and for your efforts to be a good Samaritan, especially when it didn't end up the best on your end. Representative Zerwas mentioned that this bill would put about $50 a month extra into your pocket. Is that correct?
5% or something like that.
Yeah,
you know,
Mr. Chair.
The 5%?
For each 5%?
For each, yeah.
It equates to about $50.
So, Mr. Seiler, what would that $50 mean for you?
It's only a start. It's only a start. You guys are going to see me all year next year, too. that's barely enough to scratch the surface. There isn't money for the movie. There isn't an extra $20 in my pocket. It's all gone, everybody. It's gone. All my whole life was for nothing. And you people are the ones that have to step in and help me. You need to hear my story. I got out of my hospital bed this morning. I came down here to explain this to you folks because you need to know this. I've been 3 years now since the accident. I've been suffering through that stuff just to show up here today. So, next question.
All right. We do have a few questions here. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, testifiers. I just want to say I appreciate you bringing your voice to the table. The actual people and, you know, policy at its best is really about improving people's lives, and I think this is a basic step in that direction, and I'm happy that we're seeing this, and I actually hope we can do more. To your point, that this doesn't mean a movie for you. This just means basic living. This means choosing between macaroni and cheese and maybe something healthy. And I think we need to do more, and I appreciate that we're hearing this, and this is a first step, and I appreciate the voice of the testifiers being in the room because this really is about people.
Thank you.
Representative Freiberg.
Yeah, thank you also for being here. I just wanted to, not a question so much as just a point of clarification. I assume since this raises the number from 80 to 100%, that's actually 5% times 4, so it would be $200 extra in the pocket. Is that correct?
Yes.
Representative Zerwas?
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Freiberg, correct. That the 5% increase equates to about $50 a month on average. And so last biennium we raised it by 5%, so that equated to about 50%. There's 20% left to go, so that would equal about $200 additional a month, correct? And the other part, pardon me, Mr. Chair, the other part in this bill that we haven't addressed historically is the asset limitation. And so one of the challenges is expecting folks to not have over $3,000 in assets right now. And so that's one of the other parts of this public policy that penalizes folks is we're providing them 80%, we're allowing them to keep 80% of the federal poverty guideline, and then making sure and forbidding them from keeping any type of assets in their account or in their life, quite frankly. So that's another big part of this bill.
Representative Piper?
Thank you.
Representative McDonald?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rick, I don't see your last name here.
Yeah,
so,
Rick Seiler. S-I-L-E-R.
Seiler. Mr. Seiler, thank you for your testimony and
Representative McDonald.
Your willingness to help someone in peril. And your story is quite moving. And I will speak for my colleagues here. We all recognize and understand the value of great programs in the government. We, the people, are here to protect and help, especially those such as yourselves that need the help. and unforeseen circumstances that you had no control of. And that is why we're here. Everyone in this room believes and knows and is willing to help, and we will.
Thank you.
And continue to, long after we're dead and gone. That is our number one duty, to protect those who are in most need of help. So I'm just curious, a question for you is the beautiful lady that you...
The young girl.
The young girl. What is the story of her?
She turned out to be a 19-year-old girl heading to Mankato for her first day of college.
You saved her life.
Yes, I did. And I just want to say that could be any of our grandkids or daughters. You know what I mean? We could be, you guys could be sitting at a cemetery saying, you know, bye to one of your kids. I mean, we're all parents that we expect if our kids get in trouble, another adult's going to step in and do something, you know? So, yeah, thank you for, I appreciate it.
Representative McDonald.
Well, that's all, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Seiler, and the other testifier. I mean, it's thank you for being here, and, you know, thank you for all your service, as you said, to King and Country. We really appreciate that as well. And I think part of this that's so impactful to us, it's not only that it could be somebody, our daughter, who is in that car, but that any of us could be in your situation. As the other lady said, she got T-boned by a drunk driver, and that can happen. You walk out the door, and that can happen to anyone, and you folks just had the misfortune of you know, being in the way in that respect. So, you know, thank you very much for your stories. And this policy that we're talking about is just a naughty, crazy policy on so many levels. And I, you know, I'm a co-author on the bill. I really hope that we can fix it. I appreciate that Representative Zerwas carries this bill, and it just really illustrates for me that what we're really talking about here is being able to just get the health care services you need without having to worry about, you know, meeting your other basic needs as well. And that's something that I think most Minnesotans really, if they think about it, I think most of us share the value that we think people should get the health care they need when they need it and not be impoverished because of it. Whatever your situation, and you folks, for no fault of your own, happen to just need a different level of care than many of us. But nevertheless, you should be able to get what you need because, you know, and beyond that, we need everyone to be as healthy and contributing as possible. And if we don't give people that assistance when they need it, they can't be contributing. So, you know, there are on so many levels we need to do this. So, I have no doubt that providing people, allowing people to get the care they need is actually contributes to our economy and helps us all. And we just had a presentation, maybe you were in the room, about this results first issue. And, you know, I don't think that they've evaluated the kind of program that you're talking about, but I have no doubt that it is actually a really good investment for us. The one question I have, and it's probably more for Representative Zerwas, is that, you know, everybody knows that we're in a situation now in our country when we may be dealing with a severe cut in the money that comes to the state for Medicaid. And what you folks, correct me if I'm wrong, but the program that you're getting your health care from that's requiring you to do this crazy spend-down thing is Medicaid. And if our Congress decides to block grant Medicaid and cut our funds severely, my question is, what is going to happen? If we're able to increase this bring it up to 100%, which I really would love to do. I know we would all love to do that. But, you know, what will happen in this program if Congress decides that we're going to just do a block grant and cut our funding in some way? Representative Zerwas, have you thought about that at all?
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I guess what I've done in the last couple weeks, or last week, in moving this bill and some other bills, I identify problems and know we need to find solutions. And solutions in policy where I know we have control. And for whatever reason, I'm in St. Paul and not in D.C. and I think so. We focus on what we have control over, and what we can focus on. And you know, I look at the budget that Governor Dayton laid out in the report from MMB, and they certainly aren't moving forward planning on huge federal cuts. It's quite apparent in their budget. So I guess at this point I'm not either. And looking forward to getting people the help that they deserve. And who knows? Maybe sometime soon we can contact Representative Flanagan and she can help us out.
Well, Representative Flanagan.
I'll take care of it, everyone. Never fear, Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas. Oh, am I up? Yes. Great. Great timing. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just wanted to lift up the fact that this is a good bill. And I know that folks on both sides of the aisle have introduced this in the past. And my family is directly affected by this issue. My mom's on Social Security Disability, or receives Medicaid, and what she is able to do with the money she has is incredible. But, you know, there's gaps here and there, and, you know, we step up and take care of my mom. But there's a lot of folks who don't necessarily have those other people who can step up and fill in the gaps. And this particular bill, I think, is a really important first step in making sure that folks like yourselves and like my mom have what is needed to get by. I guess the other thing that I would just say is to just thank the testifiers. It's not always easy to come and to tell your story, especially when, you know, you've gone through some trauma. And so I just want to say thank you, because as you can tell from my colleagues and I, those are the stories that really make a difference for us. And I know that if my mom could be here, she'd be sitting right next to you and talking about the importance of this bill. So I just thank you, Representative Zerwas. We don't always agree, but I think in this particular case that we can get on the same page as a good first step for supporting folks in our community with disabilities. So thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it might be staff for Representative Zerwas. The governor released a rather large tome in his budget, and I haven't read every page of it, but I didn't see how much of a improvement on a spend down issue that your bill addresses is covered in the governor's budget.
Mr. Chair, members, I do not believe the governor's budget allocates any money to this issue.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions for Ms. Preston or Mr. Seiler? Representative Precia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, awesome. Just thank you for your courage in coming up. And I do need to correct Mr. Seiler, right? On one point you said you didn't think your life was for nothing. I don't agree with that statement. I think you have a 19-year-old girl, and you have plenty of people that have benefited. So thank you.
Thank you for saying that.
To Representative Zerwas, a quick question for you. On consideration of voting for this bill, do you think we should consider this whether or not we pass it or not based on hypotheticals of what could happen in Congress, or based on the fact that the need is in front of us?
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair and members, one thing I'm really proud of with this issue, particularly over the last several years, I think it was 2 years ago when we presented this bill to a slightly different committee, but a lot of folks were here to hear it before. But one thing I've said about this bill is this is a tough legislative bill. It comes with really a huge history. It's a very expensive issue to address. And if all 201 of us got together and worked on addressing just this issue, it would be extremely challenging. One way I can guarantee you that we won't make progress on this bill is if we somehow make MA spend down a partisan issue. That's something that I've refused to do the 4 years I've been here. I will not do it moving forward. It's not about us. It's not about what happens in St. Paul. It's about what happens in people's living rooms and around their kitchen tables. And so we have a long process ahead of us while targets are set and budgets are set and we negotiate with the governor's office. But I know one way to take us off track is to somehow make this a political issue. And I think if you look at our testifiers and who will have participate in this process moving forward and historically who we've had at the Capitol, this is not a political issue. This is not an issue for politics. This is about identifying individuals that need our help and that have earned money through Social Security disability. And there's a way that if we do this right, we can let them keep the money that they've earned. And so that's what I focus on this and on this issue. And that's what I intend to keep the message at. It's a very tough issue. And the only way to make it more difficult is to make it a political issue, which I just won't do.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thanks for your testimony and Representative Ross for bringing this bill forward and highlighting this very difficult and distressing at times issues. You know, I've been in the financial services and insurance business since 1978, and I was only going to do it till I could find something decent to do, which tells you something. But, you know, one of the things I've observed is that the structures we've created in our society not only bankrupt and put in poverty the disabled, which this bill, I think, addresses, but it does it to the elderly also. And, you know, people at their most vulnerable times of life with health problems and the aging process, are faced with having their entire savings and work that they've accumulated and assets being wiped out in a short period of time. And anybody familiar with this knows, human nature being what it was, everybody's trying to avoid that any way that they can to try to save a little bit for their family. So I do think that, you know, most of the structures that are bankrupting people in vulnerable situations, whether yourselves or even the aged, have government money tied to it and regulations, okay? And, you know, I appreciate Representative Liebling's comments because I do think there's a chance that, a very high chance that that will happen. But rather than something to be feared where the feds block grant to the states, I think we need to see it as an opportunity where we will have a chance to reform the system in a way that stops bankrupting people through the process. And what I mean by that is, what I've observed with government is, versus the private sector, it only reforms itself in two ways, crisis and criticism, okay? And, you know, and a crisis does produce reforms in government. And, you know, we're probably going to be faced with a reduction somewhere in the funding. And it'll look like a crisis and be a crisis. But it's also an opportunity to reform the system that is bankrupting people who are in vulnerable situations like yourself or our elderly. So I don't fear this happening. I believe it's a necessary thing to happen if we're ever going to reform this system in a way that is more cost efficient and actually serves the needs of citizens and doesn't put them in the situation that you're in. And I've seen this firsthand but I will spare you the example of me being on the school board again, okay?
Mr. Chair, can I just respond to them real quick?
Mr. Seiler.
I agree with you totally. Unfortunately, everybody's got an opinion about this topic, and everybody wants their point to get across, and the only way for us to do this is to stick together and say we're going to do it. And I want you to know that I belong to a lot of different programs. I'm CADI, I'm certified, which mandates me to be an MA. I wouldn't even be doing this if I didn't have to be CADI certified, you know? And but you're right. Somebody hit the salt and pepper shaker in D.C., and that's basically how it's all going to go. And I want everybody to know I was financially, mentally, and physically destroyed over this. And as an insurance person, I'm sure you understand. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Remember?
Thank you, Mr. Seiler. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I first just would like to just say thank you to the testifiers for coming out, getting out of your bed, and making this journey up here to share your story. I would like to say that this bill, Representative Zeroth, this bill is a good bill. It is a bill that, as long as I've been here, the disability has been asking for. And I am glad to see that this has become a bipartisan bill, issue, that we can make better. And so I just want to say that I appreciate that. And like you, Representative Zeroth, it is my hope that this is a good thing to do and that it does not get caught up in politics, right? And that at the end of the day, I look forward to this bill becoming law, right? And it becomes law and it doesn't become ingrained within something else that calls us to make a decision because of other politics that come into this. It is needed. It is needed now. And my hope is that we can see this bill at the end of session. Law. I look forward to that.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Preston and Mr. Seiler, for your testimony today. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 225? All right.
Just to let you know, anybody have some questions, just stop me and I'll talk to you. I got some stories for you.
All right, Mr. Seiler.
Thank you, everybody. You there?
You got it? All right, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Yeah, I'm Rick Cardenas saying, thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been around here for a long time, and I've learned how to use the system to the benefit of the agency or the organizations that I've been working with. But this testimony that Rick gave was just so compelling, I don't know how you could leave without waiting till the end of the session, but to fund it right now. For me, Representative Zeroth, your statements were so spot on. You know, it just has really hit me emotionally. And I wish I could have said that before. I wish I could have said what Rick has said before, even though I have been fortunate enough through the process to gain things for many of the things that I thought were important. I just urge the committee, and I don't think you need much more pushing, to go forward this and bring that to 100%, which is still only $1,970, so that people have to exist on $990. Good thing we have a surplus. That's all I have.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Parnas, for your testimony today. Representative Zeroth, any final words?
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the support of the bill. We have made progress on this issue over the last biennium, with the first time that we've ever addressed this issue with support and actually funding it through and moving from 75% to 80%. My goal as we move forward, Mr. Chair and members, is to continue with that momentum and to continue to move the needle to get people the ability to keep the money that they've earned. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll ask that you renew my motion.
All right. I will renew the motion that House File 225, as amended, be re-referred to Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is moved on to, the motion prevails, and House File 225, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Health and Human Service Finance. With that, we are adjourned.